Success isn't just about what you achieve. It's about living a life that reflects your values and priorities. Welcome to Engineer Your Success, the podcast that helps you lead with intention and live fulfilled.
Welcome to the Engineer Your Success podcast. My name is Dr. James Bryant, and today we have Dr. Emily Grubert here on the podcast. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I'll start with the normal career stuff. I'm a professor at Notre Dame up in Northern Indiana. And right now I'm actually in a department of global affairs, which is kind of interesting because I'm trained as a civil engineer. A lot of the work that I do is basically using engineering kinds of principles and also some of my sociology training to think about policy impacts. Primarily, I work on energy transitions. And so I use a lot of my engineering experience to think a little bit about the kinds of infrastructure that we need to respond to climate change, to remake the energy system and keep people safe. And so I think a lot of what I do is really focused on bringing some of my infrastructural awareness from being a civil engineer to really trying to make my recommendations about how we move forward with a lot of the challenges we've got nowadays.
Okay. And so I typically don't get into politics on the podcast, but there's a lot of different things that's been going on with the current administration. And it sounds like it would impact the type of work that you're doing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually worked in the last administration for the Department of Energy, thinking about how some of our energy infrastructures might transition. It's been a really interesting and quite disturbing time, I think, over the last several weeks, just as an academic, but also as somebody who works on energy transitions. On the academic side, we see a lot of grants that are focused on, you know, trying to bring people into engineering or into more just outcomes with our infrastructures being threatened by a lot of the current rhetoric. The institute I'm a part of is heavily focused on poverty and sustainability, and we've lost something like $60 million in grants as a result of some of these changes. On the research side, I think a lot of the work that I do is really around how do we account for the fact that climate change is going to change a lot of our infrastructure, and how do we use the huge reinvestments that we need to make to ensure that people have access to better lives. I think hitting the civil engineer's responsibility for the health, safety, and welfare of the public, a lot of our ability to do that is being challenged by this emphasis on trying to eliminate conversations about things like environmental justice, climate change itself. So it's a pretty grim time, to be honest.
Leadership comes with high expectations. Too many responsibilities, too little time, and the constant pressure to keep up. If you're feeling stretched thin, you're not alone. At Engineer Your Success, we help leaders take back control so that they can lead with confidence, delegate effectively, and stop running on empty. You don't have to choose between success and sanity. Let's build a leadership plan that works for you. Visit EngineerYourSuccessNow.com today, because thriving isn't just for others, it's for you. Yeah, I have a client facing something very similar. A lot of research in the climate change area. And one of the conversations we've had is, why do you do what you do? Just really being able to answer that question, whether it's to provide a legacy, an environment, a place where people can live 100 years from now. If that's still your governing principle, then what that means, at least under the current regime, under the current funding schemes, you're not going to get the resources to do the research to move forward in the area. But what are some alternative paths that can help you fulfill that same mission or vision?
Right. The lack of funding on climate change right now, I think, is really challenging for a lot of people career-wise. And I'm starting to see with some of my students that are getting internships revoked and things like this. It's interesting because it's one thing for me to say as a tenured professor, like, I'm still going to work on this anyway. I'm at a big private school. My salary is safe. It's a really big challenge for me at this moment, trying to look to students and other people I work with and trying to point to what paths they might focus on. I feel an extra responsibility because I have this secure position to keep working on these things and to really try to build up an organizing capacity around showing why this is so important. But for people that I think are being directly threatened by the lack of funding in these areas, one of the things that I think about a lot is just how many other things besides climate change really touch the same kinds of infrastructures that we're all concerned about. Things like lack of maintenance over long periods of time, aging infrastructure, and all these sorts of things. Like, there's a lot of work to be done that is kind of along that sustainability path that maybe doesn't require direct climate change related funding. But yeah, I think it's going to be tricky. tricky for people, especially coming out of college and out of grad school right now, really trying to find a path. I hope that given how big of a deal this is, we can find our way again. I'm encouraged to see how much some of the states are doing. I work in the U.S. almost entirely, but also what other countries are doing. I hope that we don't lose a generation of engineers that really need to work on these things, not just want to, but actually need to work on these things.
Yeah, we're going to lose a generation of engineers that are not working on those things or just not focused on that particular facet of the overall problem that we're trying to solve.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think this is somewhat informed by my main training in civil, but some of my other training is in environmental sociology. One of the things that we see is a lot of that field has been hollowed out by the fact that there weren't jobs for a long time and that people get actively discouraged from going into these areas. I know a lot of the undergrads that I talk about will kind of say, you know, I came into environmental engineering specifically because I want to work on climate. And then I get to school and all of my classes are on wastewater treatment. Like, what's up with that? So I think as a discipline, civil and environmental specifically is so well suited to many of the challenges we face going forward, just in terms of really needing resilient infrastructure that can deliver services without harming people and the environment. And yeah, I'm not sure that we're definitely going to lose people, but there are plenty of other disciplinary contexts where we have seen a cohort disappear because there's so much uncertainty about what those jobs look like.
Yeah, I think it's just me being the optimist, trying to find a way to help bridge the gap when there's not an emphasis on things like climate change or even some of the environmental things that we've been talking about maybe over the past 2 decades.
Yeah.
Or building up to in the past 2 decades, because to some degree, there is a case to be made for people like you to continue to push forward in the research that you're doing. It's important work. It's there. You have some funding that's available and you can continue to make headway. But there's also the thought, is what I was talking about before, where, okay, what's your overall goal? How can we find other pathways that can help us to support and get to that overall goal? And I don't think it's an either or. I think most likely it's going to be a both and.
No, I think that's true. When I think about my overall goal, I want to help create a future that is fit for purpose, basically. For me, that purpose is making sure that people have the opportunity to thrive. That's why I focus on infrastructure so much. I think a lot of engineers feel this way. I think especially as the emphasis changes from doing things for environmental reasons to doing things for other reasons, you actually do end up in the same place in a lot of cases. If you're worried about infrastructure being dangerous, for example, the kinds of upgrades you might make are probably also the ones you need to make to be adaptive. I think a lot of the kinds of things that we see happening and a lot of the kinds of things that change civil engineering practice really are very practical in a lot of ways. Like, you can't build here anymore, or you need to change your concrete formulation because you're no longer able to presume these conditions going forward. And so even if it's not explicitly around climate, I do hope that we see people making choices that account for a lot of those risks, even if it's not funded that way explicitly.
Yeah, I think that will have to be the case in order for that particular portion of the civil engineering industry to continue to evolve and grow. We adapt to the conditions that are here. When new and emerging research areas come out, you don't already have proposals. You look at what the call for proposals are. Oh, that's an interesting research idea. Let's put something together so that we can address that. Now, our industry will have to respond to whatever those new emerging things are, as well as keeping pace with this the area of climate change and environmental.
I think one of the things that I come back to constantly in thinking about how I choose projects and how I teach really does come back to this professional obligation to try to change the world, to make things better for people. One of the advantages of working in the United States is that we've had a lot of infrastructure for a really long time. A lot of it's quite old. And so regardless of the reason that you're changing it over, and like my reason tends to be like, I think we really do need to respond to climate conditions and we need to adjust our infrastructure in order to stop worsening the problem. But regardless of the reason that you're doing that, there's a pretty clear case for replacement in a lot of these areas. I do hope that also we start to see quite a bit more synergistic work on just thinking about like, all right, we've got to refresh this. We actually have to maintain things better. We have to figure out what that's going to look like. I think there's a huge amount of opportunities in civil and environmental, especially really think carefully about our ethical obligation to the future. And that therefore, what does that mean we need to be considering when we're planning to switch over some of these infrastructures now?
Okay. And so how are these changes impacting what you're teaching or planning to teach in research over the next few years?
It's an interesting question. I think for me, the change in emphasis from the federal government means that a lot of my work is not going to be as responsive as it has been. So I work at this policy intersection. So when a policy is announced, a lot of what I do is analyze it and try to figure out what are the unintended consequences? What are the environmental characteristics of the system if we do it this way? So with no new policies coming out, I think there's going to be a lot less work to analyze. What I do see is kind of an interesting time in this environment is really an opportunity to talk very carefully about governance. I think civies are better at this than a lot of other disciplines, just in terms of realizing that all of the systems we touch are human systems. Like, we do have to build stuff, but like a person's going to use that or a person needs to design it. I think we're more used to the idea that people are in charge of deciding how this is going to go. And we really do think a little bit more around the human systems that surround our work than some people. There are real opportunities to think carefully about what we want the future to look like and what better options might look like next time we have the opportunity to go hard on these issues. So for me, as an academic, I think I'm going to be spending a lot more of my time thinking about governance structures and the kinds of things that we can propose and build power around to try to show people why these ways of doing things are actually going to deliver benefits to them.
Okay, that's an interesting way that you've framed that. When I'm working with businesses, then I think the same can apply in academic framework, but just in general. They talk about the problem they're trying to solve, but they typically talk about that problem from their own perspective, not the perspective of whom they're solving the problem for. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I spent a lot of time thinking about what community consultation looks like. And one of my spicier takes is when people start talking about like, well, you know, I'm an engineer. I don't deal with talking to people about their needs or whatever. It's like, that makes you a bad engineer. You're designing things for people, right? At the end of the day, I think the way that we move forward successfully is really figuring out what the needs are and how we can respond to them in ways that are scientifically driven. Like, I'm not saying that you want to go into a town hall and just be like, okay, if I had $1 million, what do you want? And everybody says, give it to me. That's not exactly what we're talking, but really trying to figure out what services do people need? And then using our technical expertise, trying to figure out how can I propose something that I think is going to meet the service you told me that you wanted, and then iterate that a little bit. You end up with much stronger projects that way. A lot of the work that I do is really around trying to figure out how you can make that process more efficient and make people feel much more heard. The concept of procedural justice comes up a lot and trying to think about who gets to help make this decision, especially when we're talking about major infrastructure investments. It matters that some groups want it to look one way and other groups want it to look another way. I think a lot of the time, if you do this well, you can come up with a solution that is pretty much acceptable to people, but you don't do that by making a bunch of decisions in a vacuum and then handing people a blueprint. So a lot of that work of figuring out how do we actually do this consultation well, and therefore how do we make much better projects that people are going to use, enjoy, and are going to actually be beneficial. Yeah, I think that's a huge area, and I'm pleased to see the industry getting better at that, but we still got a ways to go.
Thinking of that, are there any tips or tricks or best practices you would recommend?
I'm a life cycle assessment person, which means I look at projects from cradle to grave is a term that people use a lot, but try to think about what are the impacts from all the different stages of something that you're doing. One of the things that I think comes up partially from that perspective is that you get a lot out of your design phase. And especially with some of the consultation opportunities and really talking with people about what you want the system to look like, over-investing in the design phase is likely to really pay you back in later stages because you get a much bigger sense of what you might want to change before you've committed to things. I work on green buildings, and one of the things that comes up there a lot is people trying to make the argument that, you know, green buildings are way more expensive than conventional buildings. That's not really the case, but in order to get to the point where your green building is a cost savings, you have to spend a lot of time designing it well. The design phase takes longer than it might with a conventional building. But at the end of the day, it evens out and you end up with a much higher performing building with maybe pretty similar costs to conventional ones. But you do really have to spend that time up in the design phase to make sure that the electrical people are talking to the plumbing people and being careful about where they put things so that you can insulate the walls better and stuff like that. But I think that that's similar to a lot of other kinds of projects. We're over-investing in design and trying to catch all of the potential pitfalls, but also the important opportunities up front helps you a lot.
I like that general approach, and it can apply to helping listeners in their projects when making a decision, take a little bit more time to think about what the implications are going to be. Think about what it is that you are looking for. Think about whom it's going to impact. And while you're taking that time, you're able to build a better product or make a better decision or a more informed decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that really strikes me is if you do spend the time to think through the implications of what you're doing, there's actually a lot of problems that are pretty predictable and therefore mitigatable. One of the other things that I spend a lot of time on is thinking about how you safely close fossil infrastructure when it reaches end of life, or if you're trying to accelerate those closures for policy reasons or something. We're talking about high hazard infrastructure that often has really significant remediation needs. But if you know enough about the system and spend a little bit of time thinking about it, you can absolutely predict some of the things that might happen and then solve them ahead of time. But people don't do that. And so then we get all of these news headlines that are basically like, no one saw it coming, that this thing happened. In those situations, I think it's a really good illustration that spending that extra time to try to figure out what is going to happen down the line can really help you. And that's both on a safety perspective, it's on an environmental perspective, it's on a cost perspective.
The other consideration from a public works perspective or from an agency perspective is that they will set aside money for contingencies over time, depending on what's going on. That money is used or allocated for other things. It's not in a protected lockbox. So even if they saw it coming, nobody saw it was going to come this year because they took the money and allocated it to something else.
Yeah, nobody ever has enough money for teardown at the end. We do a lot of problem sets in my classes where I show my students that if you apply a reasonable discount rate, the end of life stuff becomes basically free. So no one ever saves any money for it. But it's a huge problem. I mean, we've got examples of like nuclear plants where taking the plants down at end of life is more expensive than it was to build them. I mean, in some cases, even after you adjust for inflation, like that's a totally predictable thing, but people reallocate the money. Thinking about those predictable outcomes and planning for them can really improve outcomes.
You think about them, you plan for them. In the execution of that long term, there has to be some governance or some other things that are in place that can help make sure that the resources are there to be able to execute on that. Because the further you get away from when that decision was made, the further you get away from the will to keep the funding in place to execute on it.
You know how to solve tough technical problems, but leading people, that's a different challenge. Stepping into leadership means more than just knowing your stuff. It's about inspiring, communicating, and navigating challenges with confidence. At Engineer Your Success, we help technical pros like you grow into leaders who just don't manage the work, but lead the people who do. If you're ready to lead with clarity and impact, visit engineeryoursuccessnow.com today, because thriving isn't just for others, it's for you.
And the further away you get from the people that really kind of understood in their bones why this outcome was scary, potentially.
Yeah. We've talked about your area of work, your area of expertise, and I want to spend a little bit of time just maybe talking about your career arc. What got you interested in the career that you currently have, and how has your career progressed?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do a lot of things. So probably you'll hear me over the course of this podcast talking about like, oh, I do this, I do that. A lot of what I really fell in love with infrastructure, and I think a lot of that really centered on the energy industry, but specifically around the way that energy and water systems interact. So my specific training is as a water resources engineer. But I bring this up mostly because, you know, no one ever wants to admit that you just turn into your parents. But my dad's a petroleum engineer. My mom's a water resources engineer. So I kind of ended up as an average at some point. In college, I thought I was going to be a biologist and quickly realized that I actually didn't like spending all my time in the lab. And I was not really super skilled at the field biology pieces of this. My college roommate's boyfriend came back to our dorm one time and saw me playing with this large nut from some building project that I just sort of found on the ground on campus and was very excited about, and was telling them all about this hole that I had seen and how they were putting this building up. He was a civil engineer, and he's just like, Emily, like, you really need to change your major. Like, you obviously like this stuff better. That's how I fell into the engineering side of it. And specifically, the thing that really did convince me to switch over was I took this fantastic class as an undergrad on energy systems, where the professors, and we were really lucky to have some funding to be able to do this through the class. She was really very committed to making this happen. We went on field trips. And so you were required for the class to go on two, but I basically asked, if there's an extra spot, can I go? And so I ended up over the 10 weeks of the quarter or something going on 9 or so of them. So we went to dam, we went to an oil field, we went to a geothermal field, we went to a solar plant, like all these kinds of things, gas plant. And I really loved that. So I started TAing for that class. I was a teaching assistant. And then when I graduated into the recession, I went to grad school, like many of those of us that were of that vintage, and basically ended up realizing that I wanted to be a professor. And so I started helping with teaching energy courses and all that sort of stuff.
Was there a particular thing that made you come to the realization that you wanted to teach?
Yeah, I think starting out as a teaching assistant and just seeing what that was like really gave me the bug, and realizing that the role of a professor in particular is that you get to do some of your own stuff and you'd be pretty independently driven, but you also get this, you know, in my darker days, I think about it as the real job part of my job. So when you're doing research by yourself, it can sometimes feel like, who wants this? Why am I bothering with teaching? There's 30 people here trying to get a degree and they need somebody to be standing up here. So that feels much more like an actual job. But I really enjoy helping people come to understanding about things they haven't thought about before. It's a bright spot in my day a lot of the time to get to work with people. I specifically really like teaching freshmen, showing people things about our discipline that really helps them realize like, oh, I love this, or actually I hate it and I need to make a different decision quickly, is a real privilege. I really like the teaching part.
Emily, do you have any stories that you can share of moments where you were able to provide that kind of clarity to your students?
Yeah, one of my favorites, because it's so close to my heart, is when I was at the Georgia Institute of Technology, my job before I came to Notre Dame, I was teaching the intro civil and environmental engineering class to freshmen. I had them do reflections every couple of weeks to kind of say, you know, like, what are you learning? How are you feeling about this? And at that institution, people declare their majors coming in. So, you know, they're straight out of high school and have basically said, you know, I'm going to be a civil engineer. I don't really know what that is. And I had a few of them make the comment in reflections and in other contexts. It's just like, wow, you know, we were talking about all this stuff. I had no idea that civil engineers did maintenance. Like, I thought this was all just about building stuff, but like maintaining things and making sure that they work for people is actually this really exciting piece of the field that I didn't even understand. And that sticks out to me, I guess, because it's so simple in some ways, but also like, yeah, why would you know that if you hadn't ever been told? And just seeing how excited it made people really has stuck with me.
What do you like to do for fun?
So I live in a very old house. It was built in 1885, and we're in the process of trying to restore it. Because I can't let an opportunity for energy efficiency pass me by, we are replacing these replacement aluminum windows with new wood ones that are double paned, but in this like fancy Japanese way that makes it so that they fit the old house. So we're DIY replacing windows in this old house, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. And I like the fact that you're trying to keep the historical look, but also bringing in the modern day energy efficiency using engineered material so it'll fit within the motif.
Yeah, that's engineered hardwood, and it's really amazing to see the performance of it actually.
No, that's cool. Is there anything else that you want to talk about that you want to make sure that we cover in the podcast?
Do you have like student listeners, or are you mostly professionals?
I do have some student listeners. Last year and this year, I'm working for a program for the Michigan Department of Transportation where I do some leadership development content for their college interns. We call it the Transportation Leadership Launchpad. We cover the different jobs that you can find within the transportation industry, both working for state DOT or working in the private sector supporting a state DOT. We talk about communication and networking skills. What do you need? Like, you want to make sure that you're able to talk to folks and convey your message. Another piece we talked about really was how do you navigate this whole acceptance and belonging from the perspective of, I ask the students, hey, I want everybody to raise your hand if you think that the organization, the state DOT or the engineer, the contractor, should accept you exactly as you are. All students, they all raise their hand. We want to be accepted. So we're talking. Then we get to another part of the discussion. I say, okay, how many of you are willing to accept the organizations that you want to work for as they are? Nobody raises their hand and they're thinking like, why would I do that? The whole point is sometimes we have to be aware that we have expectations on others that we're not willing to meet ourselves. Emily, earlier you mentioned about being a PE and professional responsibility. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, it's interesting because as a professor, it's not necessarily expected of me that I would have my license, but it was really important to me to get it. And I think part of that is just that I really appreciate being part of a profession rather than just a job, right? And I think this probably resonates with a lot of the folks out there that have been doing this a little longer. But one of the things that I really love about civil in particular is that we do have such a huge opportunity to really affect people's lives. And when we take that responsibility seriously and when we really kind of bring our whole effort to making sure that our work is actually improving people's lives, keeping people safe, making sure that for generations into the future, we're actually doing well, it's a really neat group to be part of. And so I think for people that are just getting into this field, it can seem a little stodgy sometimes, but genuinely, it's such an important community of people that are there to kind of help you think through what is it that we're actually trying to accomplish here. Like, you're not just trying to fix a road. You're trying to make it so that people can get to work. Yeah. And you are trying to make it so that ambulances can get to hospitals and stuff like this. Like, there are so many amazing things that we get to do that it's a real privilege to be able to do this kind of work. To those of you that are just starting out in the field, like, congratulations, welcome. And I think there's so many of us that are really invested in all of our success collectively, because we really do make the world better when we do our best work.
There are times when I typically will do this in an episode where we're going to turn things around. So now you are the interviewer and I'm the interviewee. What questions do you have for me?
I love it. What would you like your audience to, in looking back on what they've got out of listening to this podcast a few years from now, what do you hope they take away?
Well, so if I look at the catalog of content I've been able to curate individually, as well as having guests like you come on, if we're 5 years into the future and someone is looking back and saying, what was Engineer Your Success about, or what is it about? I want them to be able to look back and see that through my story, through other people's stories, that they can actually continue to evolve and grow. They don't have to blindly choose between success professionally and success personally, that they understand that there may be hard decisions that they have to make, but that they understand that they can have both. It may not look like how you define success right now. It may not look the same, but you can have both.
That's amazing. Super inspiring. What are you proudest of in the work that you've done? And that can be on the podcast. It can be more generally.
Whew, what am I proudest of? I would say the thing I'm most proudest of was the decision that I made to make sure that I focused on what mattered most to me. So let me tell you kind of what was going on. I have, you know, been working in Washington, D.C. I live in Richmond, Virginia, and I was commuting up there every day. Things were going fine. At least I thought they were going fine. From my perspective, from a work perspective, they were going fine. From a life perspective, not so much. But eventually my youngest son is born. He was born at 26 weeks in the day. That really started me on this process of self-discovery. I asked myself three questions that I say changed my life. Do you want to win at work? And the answer to that question for me was yes. Do you want to win at home? Of course, I don't know anybody who doesn't want to have a winning home life. The third question was, are you winning at work and at home? And because I could not answer that question yes, I began to put things in place to help me design and live a life where I can win at work and at home. So I started that process. A year and a half passed, and I was setting boundaries, still delivering at work. I did have the ability to work off site at that time because different changes that were going on at the company and what was going on with my situation. This is before work from home was a thing. There's an opportunity for a promotion. They tell me, hey, James, we would like for you to apply for this job and we would like for you to get this promotion. And they said, it's one catch. What's the catch? I said, well, you have to come to Washington, D.C. every day if you want this promotion. And I said, no, thank you. And, you know, part of the questions were, you know, what happened to your ambition? When we first hired you, you said that you wanted to do this. You and your wife talked about moving up here, and where's your ambition and what do you want to do? I was like, I still have ambition. It's the focus of that ambition is different. You know, now the focus of that ambition
is being able to create an environment where I can spend time with my family and produce here at work. Now, the question that I have for them, are you unhappy with the level of work in the product that I'm delivering right now? And their answer was no. And I said, well, if you guys are happy with the current situation, know that I'm happy with the current situation. And that was it. Eventually, 2 or 3 months later, they wind up giving me the promotion anyway, without the requirement to be in DC every day. But I think that was one of the things, when I think back on my career, would be one of the things that I'm most proud of.
Yeah, that's amazing. Sounds like you made them realize that you were actually worth it to make the adjustments to make you succeed too. That's awesome.
Yeah. No, those are great questions. Emily, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast. If some of the folks that are listening would like to get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to reach out?
Email is best. So it's egrubert@nd.edu, first initial, last name, and then Notre Dame. If you want to learn more about what it means to transition our infrastructure, if you want to learn more about lead remediation in your house, we have a little baby, so we've been working on that a lot to try to keep that safe. Safety and infrastructure and energy stuff, I am your person.
Hey, Emily, I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Likewise.
It's gone through different areas that I don't always get a chance to explore on the podcast. So I want to thank you for being such a great guest and allowing us to explore those different avenues.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all the work you do.
Yeah. And so I'm going to end this podcast like I end every podcast. And that's this: many people know what to do. Few people know how to do it. And there's a select group of people that actually follow through and do it. And Emily, I want to thank you for being part of that select few.